KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local Hour News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Okay, let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone, I have Thomas Giboy with ABC4. Good morning, Thomas.
It's Nate. Filling in for Nate. Thomas today. My app keeps crashing. Hopefully it'll stay on while we're talking to you this morning. Hey, a pretty nice day for Park City overall. Highs near 43. Should have much calmer conditions into the weekend as well. We have a slight chance of a shower on Saturday, a chance of some snow. Otherwise, mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies continuing. Temperatures, overnight lows in the 20s, highs in the 40s through Sunday. Into next week, lots of sunshine, warming temperatures as high pressure will be in place. Low 50s for highs on Monday, 53 on Tuesday. And then we do have a system that could start to bring moisture back into the area late Wednesday with a good chance of rain and snow showers as temperatures are in the low 50s on Thursday. So rain and snow showers are likely, and we could have some active weather that will continue into next weekend.
Okay. Thanks, Nate, and have a good weekend.
You bet. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Coming up, we will have an avalanche report. With the Utah Avalanche Center is on now. Hi, Nikki.
Hey, you got me?
Yes, ma'am.
Awesome. So the downslope winds are obviously cranking across the valley, but they're a little bit mellower in the mountains, but we are still seeing them move some snow. With all the fresh snow and the drifted snow, traveling and riding conditions should be excellent today. Yesterday wasn't as busy in the backcountry. We saw a few less avalanches, but we still saw some reports of sensitive slough slabs, both within the new snow and the wind-drifted snow. Over the past few days, we've seen quite a few sensitive slough slabs. Most of these are D1 to D2 in size, so 15 to 50 feet wide and running up to 100 feet long. Today, we've got two main problems to think about. The first is just going to be that wind-drifted snow. So with those elevated easterly winds and soft snow available for transport, we're going to continue to see soft slabs forming 1 to 3 feet deep. The winds will increase throughout the day, but it won't take much to move all that new snow around. So these will be most pronounced on leeward-facing slopes, but high winds can load any aspect due to the swirling and changing wind directions in the mountains. So look for signs of wind-drifted snow, such as textured pillow-shaped features, and avoid those slopes. The second thing we want to think about is just going to be that new snow. So most of the new snow instability should begin to settle out today. However, outside the wind zone, you may still find some sensitive soft slabs or long-running sloughs. And then finally, the elevated easterly winds should keep the snow surface cooler today, but when the sun comes out and it hits that new snow for the first time, we could start to see some pinwheels, rollerballs, or small point releases. So if the snow surface begins to dampen or show signs of wet snow, might be a good idea just to change aspects to a colder side. So the avalanche danger is going to be considerable at upper elevation terrain facing northwest through west to southeast, where easterly winds continue to form unstable slabs of wind-drifted snow, and the remaining upper and all mid-elevation slopes will have a moderate danger.
Nikki, as we look at next week's weather forecast, and it looks really warm, what is that likely to do in terms of avalanche danger?
As for the avalanche danger, we'll probably see it begin dropping over the next week with no new snow or wind really on the horizon. We could see some problems like wet snow instabilities, so more of those point releases, roller balls, and then we see those get larger as the temperatures increase and we don't see a good overnight refreeze.
Okay. Nikki, thanks, and have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too.
This is Roger Goldman. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Coming up, we will have our monthly chat with South Summit School Superintendent Greg Maughan. Then we'll be speaking by phone with Park City Councilmember Jeremy Rubel with a debrief from last night's council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Justin Costco, the Executive Director of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame, to talk about the upcoming induction ceremony. Stay tuned. Let's do a little local news. The Wasatch County Council may adopt a public comment policy after hate speech hijacked a Midway Council meeting earlier this year.
During a work session Wednesday, the Wasatch County Council discussed whether to create a public comment policy. In the wake of an incident at a February Midway City Council meeting when virtual attendees made racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-LDS comments, County Manager Dustin Graybaugh said he came up with a list of comment policy ideas based on other local entities' guidelines.
As I work with the attorney's office on a potential policy, I wanted to get your input on a few items.
Options the council discussed included whether to require members of the public to list their addresses before commenting, what time limit to set on public comment, and whether virtual comments should be permitted. As far as putting certain requirements on the topic of comments, Graybaugh said that's a more sensitive issue.
You cannot limit comments based on their content of communication if we're picking and choosing. We like what you're saying, we don't like what you're saying. What we can do, though, is limit it in these broad categories of if someone is making a comment that's not relevant, not under our jurisdiction.
That approach would give the council some leeway to stop hateful comments like the ones Midway encountered. The discussion was about the public comment policy for regular meetings, not for public hearings about specific topics. Councilmember Luke Searle said he wanted the public to understand the intent of any new policy.
The media would love to just say that we're trying to limit things when I think they're just trying to create some structure and even-handedness.
Councilmember Spencer Park agreed.
I think we're a fan of three-hour public comments if it's needed. I just think we don't want it to happen in Midway.
Graybaugh will now work with the attorney's office to draft a public comment policy for the council to consider. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Park City and Basin Recreation are running a joint survey to get resident and visitor feedback about the e-bike rules on local trails. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
Together, Park City and the Snyderville Basin Recreation District, better known as Basin Rec, control hundreds of miles of paved and dirt trails heavily used by mountain bikers and hikers. When it comes to e-bikes, the rules differ. Park City allows e-bikes on single-track trails for people over 65 or those with a mobility disability. Basin Rec only allows e-bikes on paved paths. A survey was recently launched to gather public feedback about e-bikes, so the two trail systems can have consistent rules, Basin Rec Director Dana Jones said.
We don't want our users to have to worry about whose jurisdiction they're in. We want our whole operation to be seamless.
Park City Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieter said the survey data will be used to create a final report, which will be shared with the City Council.
If we need to make changes, we would consider those, and if not, stay with status quo.
Dieter said the survey ends April 1st. A link can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
February storms boosted Utah's snowpack above normal for the first time this year. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the Great Salt Lake and Utah's reservoirs benefit from the increased water.
The Utah Snow Survey measures and monitors snowpack across the state. The data about snowpack helps with conservation planning, water supply management, flood control, drought and avalanche predictions, climate modeling, and recreation. There are 138 snow telemetry or snowdal weather station sites to measure snowpack in Utah and 900 in the Intermountain West. Jordan Clayton is the snow survey supervisor for the Utah Snow Survey. He says while the sites are helpful for recreation purposes, their main purpose is to determine the snow water equivalent of the snowpack.
The main reason why we put in these weather stations was for water supply forecasting. We want to understand how much water we're going to get when all this snow melts.
After the Great Salt Lake's historic low in November 2022, he said Utah needs all the snow and water it can get. The record snowpack last year helped, but Utah lawmakers and residents alike have been hoping for another above-normal snowpack year. More snowpack helps outdoor recreation and boosts the Great Salt Lake and reservoir levels. Clayton says the slow start to the 2023-2024 winter season caused concern, which faded by February.
December was pretty disappointing, and we were getting pretty nervous from a snow survey perspective. And then February came along and really got us back on track to where we want to be.
Clayton says six of the snowdal weather stations broke a record in February. As of March 14th, the state is at about 123% of the normal snow water equivalent.
We're guaranteed now to have an above normal snowpack season for the state of Utah.
Clayton says any new snow this season is now like a bonus. Utah's reservoirs, excluding Lake Powell, are at 82% capacity, 30% higher than this time last year. That means a lot of the water the state gets this season can go to the Great Salt Lake. Soil moisture in the state is also above normal right now, which helps get water into reservoirs and lakes.
When we have really dry, kind of parched soils, they soak up a lot of that snow moisture, and it doesn't make it downstream.
Fire danger and flooding are also impacted by snowpack. If the snow melts slowly, it lowers the flooding risk. A slow melt also keeps the soil moist, reducing wildfire danger. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The South Summit School Board had its regular meeting last night. Here with our monthly chat, or for our monthly chat, is Superintendent Greg Mond. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
Thanks for being here, Greg. Let's start with fees. I know fees were on the agenda last night.
Yeah.
What does a school district charge fees for, and what was the discussion about?
So schools, secondary schools, you know, in particular, charge fees for just a whole myriad of reasons. You know, the first response I want to say is, yeah, why do we charge fees? And I think that's the right lens to use, because we don't want to charge a fee if there's not a cost that we need to be able to recruit. So examples of some of the fees, there's curricular fees, academic fees, so things like lab fees, AP exam fees, things like that, concurrent enrollment class, some of the concurrent enrollment classes. A lot of classes have fees to help cover the cost of some of the consumables, things like that. And then there's also, obviously, one of the greater areas as far as what feels like the bulk of fees tends to be extracurricular activities. So that's why fees are charged, you know, so that programs are able to run the way you want them to be run. And so the conversation last night, the was great. We had a public hearing on fees last night, and then our board approved the fee schedule for the first reading. It will come up next month again. It was a great conversation. Our board really looked at the fees, and they asked the principals to go back and get a little bit more clarity on a couple of items, just so that it would be as transparent and easy to understand to really get what everything is for and why it's being charged and where it goes.
You know, as you're talking, I'm in my mind getting a distinction. You talk about something like a lab fee. I mean, that seems to me, you know, intuitively to be part and parcel of the basic academic science curriculum. And why do we why is that subject to a fee?
So, lab fees. You know, when you go to college, you're going to have lab fees as well. Being a former science teacher, I could have taught science from the book, mm-hmm. or I could have taught science from the hands-on. And you know, one of the labs that we did frequent, you know, each year was dissecting fetal pigs, for example. And you know, and then you can make comparisons between the anatomy and physiology between humans and pigs, because there's a lot of similarities. And so
it's some of the people that I know, but
yeah, right. So as you look at me, no. So it really, it's trying to give the best experience we can. Mm-hmm. We really want to give a Cadillac education on a metro budget.
Yeah.
And that's not always possible. And so there is a need for fees. Mm-hmm. It's something that the legislature has talked about for a couple of years, and this year took action on that will kind of go into effect a year down the road, so the 25-26 year, where some of the curricular fees will be waived, there will still be fees, just not as many of the academic fees.
So when the legislature does something like that, there's obviously going to be a budget implication for you.
There is.
Right. So where does that money come from?
Well, so that was part of a fiscal note with the legislation this year. Mm-hmm. And so there is a financial piece there that will be passed on to school districts to help cover some of those costs. We're hoping that eventually the funding source will shift from one-time money to ongoing money, because
It's an ongoing issue,
and if we really want to provide the best education, then you know it really should be taken care of with ongoing funds.
So, if I understand what you just said, that at least this time, or for one time only, the legislature is going to provide some supplemental funding to help offset this fact that you won't be able to charge fees next year.
Right. Not for this upcoming year, but the following year.
Okay.
That's right. Yep.
I want to give you a chance to brag. I want to give you a chance to brag. One item on the agenda was the recognition of Sterling Scholars. First, tell us what a Sterling Scholar is.
Well, so a Sterling Scholar, first of all, there's several areas. There's about 15 areas that students can be, you know, be nominated or run to be a Sterling Scholar. And really, it's kind of a combination of their academics, so they're kind of their scholarly, you know, category, whether that be dance or science or whatever, leadership in their school and community service or citizenship, and then they have an interview also. And those scores are kind of combined to determine who the winner is and who the runners up are. So this year was great for South Summit. We had a winner. Braxton Blazard was a Sterling Scholar winner for Ag Science. Braden Osgathorpe was a runner-up in Business and Marketing. Neve Stein was a runner-up in Science. We also had Dayton Fry, who was a runner-up in Science. Usually you don't get two students as runners-up in the same category, but because one of them's from South Summit High School and one of them's from Silver Summit Academy, it was unique, and it was really awesome. And then we had Cameron Harris, who was runner-up in Skilled and Technical Science. So proud of our students. They did a great job. They really represented South Summit School District well.
And what is the prize if you're a Sterling Scholar?
Well, there's scholarship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly something that's really nice to put on your resume, on your applications, things like that. But there's scholarships that come with that.
Any information about where any of these kids are choosing to go to college?
I don't have any of that with me right now, but part of the process of applying, they're applying for colleges. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they will ultimately land. I know at the banquet I was able to talk to quite a few of the kids, and some of them are planning on going on a 2-year service mission. Some of them are planning on going into college, you know, right after. So it was such a fun experience to get to have the conversations and see what their plans are.
So in the next month, or maybe next month or the month after, we'll be able to talk about where some of your kids are going.
Yep.
Because it's exciting to see these kids getting launched into new pursuits.
Yep.
I know there were some other presentations on the agenda last night. Any that were of particular interest?
Well, last night was a packed board meeting as far as the agenda goes. Our social workers reported out. We had a spotlight on our elementary school, on South Summit Elementary, where they shared a lot of their formative data that they used to help kind of inform instruction, things like that.
Well, let's stay with that for a minute. What did you learn in that presentation about how your students were performing?
Their presentation focused mostly on the primary grades, the mm-hmm. earlier grades, because we had another report from our teaching and learning department that took the assessments from about third grade on up. They presented on that. So the elementary school focused a lot of their time and data on those earlier grades. And we have a lot of positive results with it's a cadence is an example. It's a reading assessment, mm-hmm. you know, and so we're seeing lots of positive results in those formative assessments around reading and math specifically, and how we're using that data to not only inform what's happening in the classroom, but also interventions that need to take place to provide support for individual students.
When we zoom back a little bit, Greg, I mean, intuitively one would think that what happens in those earlier years really drives what happens in the later years. Is that what you find? That
absolutely. Okay. And that's supported by research. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are things in society that are determined off of things like the number of students reading on grade level at third grade. Mm-hmm. You know, they predict. I've read that they predict the number of beds in a prison in an area based on third grade reading. Things like that. And that's a bold statement. Please don't quote me. I am saying it on air. It's critical. And those primary years are so important to student success later on.
So it's only with the kind of feedback that you're getting that you can decide what kind of resources to put into those.
That's right.
Levels. And that's why you do that.
It is. And that's where principals and instructional coaches, that's where they really come into play. Principals in particular, because they allocate their resources within their building based on needs.
Last time we spoke, you were on the way to the legislature.
Yeah.
You mentioned one sort of significant piece of legislation that affects the school districts, and that's the issue regarding fees. Any other piece of legislation that either passed or didn't pass that would have affected the school district?
Well, there's lots that passed that affect the school district. And right now, we're kind of in this place where we're taking a look at where the chips are falling, you know, all across the board, because there were so many bills that were passed. A couple others, you know, we talked about fees. A couple that I highlighted last night was the school safety amendment. It was a House Bill 84. And that's just, we've got a district safety committee that's working with that'll be working with the state safety coordinator or commissioner and developing our plan to make sure we're doing everything we can and need to make sure students and staff are safe. And we talked a little bit about the NESS, which is Necessary Existent Small School bill. It was circled, so it'll come up in the next legislative session, hopefully. Lots of legislation to talk about, and last night where we landed was we'll be bringing more of that to the board as we get some of the direction from USBE and things on the implications and how we'll be expected to implement some of the things.
Well, quickly before we go, Greg, got to have an update on your housing project.
Yeah, so our business administrator, Adam Robinson, reported out a little bit on that. And we've been meeting with Habitat for Humanity. And really where we're at right now with it is the board scheduled a working session to specifically talk about the housing project moving forward. You know, the deeper you get into anything, the more you learn. And so we want to make sure that our board is completely informed on everything, because what we're doing has very long-lasting implications, especially when you're talking about things like deed restrictions and stuff like that. So it's I want to move fast, but at the same time, I want to do it right.
Okay. So. Well, we'll continue to be interested in how that progresses.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg, for spending time with us. We will be right back after this. The Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Council member Jeremy Bell is on the phone with us with a debrief. Morning, Jeremy.
Good morning.
We're having infrastructure challenges, and we'll eventually get to a discussion about the potential for additional new IT infrastructure, because I know that was an agenda item last night. But let's start with the housing proposal on the open space next to the mine bench. That came up last night. Can you explain what it was that you heard about?
Yeah, we went to RFP to go ask the market. You know, I think City Manager Matt Dias put it well when he was on the radio earlier this week, to explore possibilities in the area. You know, got some proposals back. There was a selection committee. There have been a number of discussions about it, and basically this was the capstone of bringing back their selected proposal to council and engaging sentiment to move forward.
Okay, let's take a step back. For those of us who are visually challenged as I am, if you were to describe where this parcel is, how could we try to paint a radio picture for our listeners?
Well, if you're going up to Silver Lake in Deer Valley, up Marsac, you know, also called the Mine Road, it's State Route 224 as well, a lot of names for it. It's the area that would be on your right-hand side as you're going uphill before you would take a left towards Silver Lake on Wheaton Way there, mm-hmm. or if you continue around the bend up towards Empire Pass, Empire Lodge area.
So I have a bunch of mine buildings that you go past on the right. So is it beyond those?
Well, that's part of the parcel.
Okay.
So there's the disturbed portion of the site, and then there's the upper portion of the site, which currently is covered in, you know, mature trees. There's a trail that goes through there, things like that.
Okay. So I understand it was a substantial development. It would involve, what, some 300 housing units across and a number of beds. What was council's reaction?
Yeah, it was a bit mixed. I think overall the council is supportive of looking for solutions for our workforce in town, including our seasonal workforce. We're also supportive of looking for solutions for affordable workforce housing, public-private partnerships. We heard a lot from the hotels and clubs in the area and their need for workforce. And then the conversation also included, you know, is this the right location for it? It's a challenging site. The portion of the site that was selected by the committee and brought forward was that sort of landscaped portion that's zoned recreation open space up there, not the disturbed portion of the site where the parking or the mine is at the moment. There's also some public works on that part of the site. And really, you know, is this the right place to do it? Is this the right place to put 660 beds and 220 more cars, given the issues with that road? And, you know, we've heard a lot in the past. There's some safety things going on there. You know, at the end of the day, the answer was no, this probably isn't the right project for that location at this time.
And I take it you had a fair amount of community input, both for and against?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. So, and I take it that this thing is effectively gone. I mean, the decision was not to proceed. Have I got that right?
That's right. The decision was not to proceed with the results of that procurement exercise at this time.
Okay. But that leaves an important issue open, which is the continued pursuit of potential affordable housing. I understand that a representative from Larry H. Miller sort of spoke up about Richardson Flat. Can you tell us what you heard about that, and where do you think we go from here on that?
Yeah, nothing much beyond what was said in the public comment. Sounds like they're looking at some of the property they own there and maybe are going to be coming to the city with some ideas in the future. But we don't have anything beyond what was said last night. You know, the other thing I'll say about the proposal that was brought forth, the selected partner, potential partner there, Servitas, really did come up with an amazing proposal from a financial model and sort of bed delivery perspective. So we have other parcels in the city we'd hope to look at potentially with them and see if we can't do something together in a different location. We've been talking in the past about Clark Ranch. There's some other sites along the 248 corridor that we've discussed recently. We have the, obviously, Bonanza Park project. I'm sure we'll touch on a bit here. So, you know, the future is bright, but, you know, it doesn't always make sense to push forward just because there's an option on the table, right? There's a lot of different priorities to balance.
Okay. You mentioned Bonanza Park. It seems like we can't have a discussion about a council meeting without talking about Bonanza Park. I understand that there was something called an RSOQ. Can you explain what one of those is and why you need one?
Yeah, so it's a request for statement of qualifications. We had a little bit of discussion last night with one of our city attorneys who explained, you know, there's a number of different names for procurement tools. This one is sort of a interim tool, the way I look at it. You know, it's more advanced than doing nothing. And it's not quite going to a request for proposals, which generally end in either a contract or the decision not to proceed. So what this is saying, look, we've reached out to the community. We've done a lot of engagement. We've gathered a lot of feedback. We have these focus groups, these advisory groups. We have the survey results, the meetings, you know, all this stuff. We also have our current land management code and zoning. We have our general plan. We have results from those engagement exercises of potential changes to our land management code that would need to go through the planning process and be evaluated by the planning department and planning commission. But kind of putting all those pieces together and then putting that out to the market and asking professional firms who specialize in this stuff to tell us if they're interested and what they've done other places, what some ideas might be for this. And as a result of that exercise, we could pick one or many firms to work with as we move forward. So way to look at this is it kind of fast tracks in parallel with continuing the community engagement, helps us get to an actual shovel in the ground sooner than if we, you know, wait to this fall to get all the ducks in a row. And then, you know, the planning process could take a really long time. I mean, the goal here is let's get to action.
Okay, so I think what you just said actually sort of makes it somewhat clear to me, which is you're trying to speed up the process by finding qualified vendors now so that if and so that when you want to pull the trigger with a real RFP for a concrete proposal, you're that much further along the road. Is that basically right?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, and again, what would be the ideal time frame from your perspective to get that RFP out? I mean, I think a lot of people in the community are frustrated with how long this has been taken. I know there's some urgency to get it done, but also, you know, the countervailing need to get it done properly. When would you hope to see an RFP out the door?
Well, speaking personally, as soon as possible.
I also want you to speak practically.
Yeah. So practically, this RSOQ is a really good option, and it was really encouraging to see it brought forward by the staff. We're not getting a lot of new information from the engagement process at this time. We've gotten a ton of, how many times can you ask the same question, right? So we've got a ton of information. It's really valuable feedback, and we've talked in the past about narrowing the funnel. This is another step in narrowing that funnel. So practically speaking, if we do this, which we're going to, and do it in parallel with the engagement exercise that's supposed to wrap up in the next few months, practically speaking, we could probably see an RFP hit the street this fall.
Okay, I want to talk, I understand that you talked a little bit about recreation fees. First, with respect to sort of the general recreation fees, will there be significant fee increases this year? And how do you balance the needs of the local Park City residents versus Greater Summit County?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a bit intricate. The council direction and sentiment, which has been for a while now, is to prioritize our taxpayers and those who live in the Park City municipal boundaries. That being said, we also have an interlocal agreement with Basin Rec that our taxpayers and Park City municipal residents benefit from. So we want to uphold that as well. What that really does on the recreation and ice front is guarantees that everyone pays the same price. Mm-hmm. There are mechanisms we can use to prioritize use of the resources for the Park City municipal residents. But that's really the direction that was reinforced. So what we saw last night were some pretty great proposals from the staff that follows that policy direction to say, here's how we can prioritize use of our resources, which are limited, for those who live in the city. And here's how we can also keep fees as low as possible for those within the city and the Basin Rec area, while balancing the demand from outside of our boundaries and not denying access, but looking for cost recovery of their use of our facilities as well.
So among other things, I take it an example of that would be allowing Park City residents for example, be able to reserve a tee time at the golf course earlier. When you say you maintain the same price but give a little bit of priority, is that an example?
Yeah, and actually there's local pricing, which includes the same Basin Rec area and Park City proper boundaries for golf, but yes, there was discussion around booking priority. Maybe it's a day earlier, maybe it's a week earlier, all that's being evaluated. There's also some discussion around possibility of season passes for those within city boundaries to see if that's a program that can be resurrected. But we have to be careful when we do these things, right? We don't want to create a deficit that then requires a greater subsidy, which ultimately costs everybody more to use the resource. So it's a pretty tough balancing act, but the staff's really sharpening the pencil on it and it's encouraging the direction we're going.
I do want to touch on the IT infrastructure proposal. My understanding is that there was a discussion of a major upgrade in fiber infrastructure. Why would the city need to do that itself as opposed to some private vendor coming in and laying the fiber?
We may not, is the short answer. And that was kind of the discussion with the council was, let's really explore if there's some private partnerships we can leverage here and then come back to us with some more information, but that the council was supportive in infrastructure investments and excited that, we're planning for the future and being very proactive there.
And again, why was it need? What's the underlying need for a fiber infrastructure in town? Why was this presented as something that was important for city operations?
Yeah, it sounded like the last major upgrade was prior to the Olympics 20 or so years ago. And, you know, as technology goes, you got to stay current. And the further you fall behind, the harder it is to catch up. So this is just a look at saying, you know, 2034 is coming sooner than we think. Our growth has been exponential. It's just time to invest in this.
Okay, before we go, Jeremy, I do want to touch on one more thing, which is I know there was a brief discussion about employee comp. And, you know, and I take it that's part of the upcoming budget process. Do you think the city's doing a good job at retaining employees, given the, sort of the economic challenges of the cost of living in this area?
Yeah, I do. Our HR department has been really transformational in the past year or two on new programs, new benefits. We've talked a lot about how we incentivize employees, how we recruit and retain. And this is another evolution in our policies that should really help. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that, you know, we pay relative to our market conditions, not, you know, relative to things that are less relevant to our unique challenges. So, it's an exciting thing forward. We've got to invest in our people. We've got to retain our people. And there was also a discussion around housing, you know. That's a key component here. All these puzzle pieces really come to a complete solution, but it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Okay, Jeremy, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. The U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame will hold its annual induction ceremony next week. On the phone to tell us a bit about the history of the hall and the upcoming ceremony is Executive Director Justin Koski. Good morning, Justin, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. How are you today?
Excellent, sir. So, Justin, share with us a little bit about the background of the hall. How long has it been in existence, and how did it end up in Minnesota?
Yeah, actually, Michigan, Upper Peninsula, Michigan. The hall's been in existence since 1954. We established ourselves as a museum, and then in 1956, they had things in place for the first ever election of Hall of Fame honor members. So we've been doing that diligently since. We've inducted about 480 individuals over those close to 70 years, and the museum sits there in Ishpeming, Michigan, which is, you know, known as the birthplace of organized skiing in America, the home base where the ski team was really founded under the name National Ski Association in 1904.
And is there a ski mountain in Ishpeming?
Yeah, there's Marquette Mountain is about 15 miles away or so. Then we have ski jumping jumps all over in the UP, including a ski flying jump in Ironwood, Copper Peak.
Okay. So what are the criteria for induction into the Hall of Fame?
The criteria for athletes and non-athletes are slightly different. Like any Hall of Fame, we induct both sets of people. On the athlete side, they have to have had World Cup podiums and Olympic appearances and Olympic placement that they've been able to achieve. And then on the builder side, like athletes, they have to have made a significant impact on the sport of skiing and snowboarding in the country.
Okay. And who decides? Who are the people who vote on the inductees?
Yeah, there's a whole process. So there's two different groups of people that are very active in the overall selection process. The first of which is our selection committee, and that's chaired by local Park City friend of us all, Tom Kelly, as the chairman of that selection committee. And there's 24 other individuals on there that are, you know, prominent people all across the country. Really, we try to be as genre diverse and also geographically, with that committee. There's people on there from different media veins. There's people on there from different regional museums, different organizations like the National Ski Areas Association, Ski Team, et cetera. And then same thing on the National Voting Panel. The National Voting Panel is 480 people that cast votes every year. Various different boards that we involve, various different, you know, groups of people that activate and cast their votes each year on their top choices for athlete and builder.
How many inductees would be in a typical year, and how many inductees we have at this year?
Typically, you'll see four athletes, three builders, and then somebody coming in out of our heritage category, so seven or eight. This year, we selected eight, but Jeff Brushy had to defer to next year to be honored in Lake Placid because of a scheduling conflict with another snowboarding event that he's going to be at next weekend that he had committed to prior to the induction. But typically, you'll see eight, yeah.
And do any of this year's inductees have a Park City connection?
I mean, everybody does, right? It's such a hub. Most people's, you know, second home or home away from home. I'll give you a couple examples from this year's class. Shannon Barkey and Billy DeMong, really from North Lake Tahoe and Lake Placid, New York, respectively, but really, you know, have built their careers in this community in Park City, raised their families there, you know, et cetera. So those are two great examples of that. You know, and then again, with ties to the area, you know, Les Otten comes to mind. If you remember Les from the American Ski Company, Les was instrumental in developing the canyons way back. And therefore, you know, probably holds a special place for those locals that have been, you know, living, working, and skiing and snowboarding in that community.
And if we look back in terms of existing Hall of Fame denizens, residents, are there other ones that come from Park City that you can just name off the top of your head?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, going down the list, you know, you've got, you know, people like Bill Marolt and Howard Peterson that were at the helm of the team for different stints. People like Hank Tauber, who's been active with the team and with Fifth, and many, many, many people. You know, if you go down, you got Peekaboo. You know, you've got people like Trace Worthington, Fuzz Feddersen. I mean, we could go all day. There's quite a few of them there.
Okay. I know that the induction is not just a single ceremony. Can you talk to us about the different events that will take place as part of the induction process?
Yeah, totally. Thanks for asking. So we fire things up next week on Wednesday. There's a open to public local welcome reception that we're doing in coordination with Connie Nelson and the team up at the Elf Engen Museum and up at Utah Olympic Park. Things kind of kick off from there. That's 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday night. Thursday, we're doing an on-snow event in collaboration with the team at Sundance. Thursday night, we're doing a ski history trivia event at the Black Rock Mountain, which should be pretty cool. Friday, we're going to Solitude on snow, and we're also doing a Free the Heel Nordic ski over at White Pine. And Friday night is the International Skiing History Awards award ceremony that kind of kicks off on the tail end of our big fashion show that we're running at Black Rock Mountain from 3 to 5. So it's like an après party with over 40 fashion brands that have submitted looks to walk the runway featuring next year's ski and snowboard clothing from all your top brands. So that's kind of cool. We got Snow Tequila and High West Whiskey for sponsors for the week, which is going to be you know, adding to the overall event. And then, of course, Saturday, things kind of culminate there at 5 o'clock with the pre-function red carpet reception that Coca-Cola is sponsoring and Monster. And then we go right into the induction Saturday evening.
And where will the Saturday evening events take place?
Yeah, everything that I just mentioned, with the exception of the Elf Engen Museum event, that all is happening up at the Black Rock Mountain Resort.
And where is that?
It's up on the way to Heber City, Camas area.
Okay. So it's out. Oh, it's out 248. That's where Black Rock is. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
And are any of the events open to the public?
Yeah. Everything's available at skihall.com, and all the events are that are open to the public. It states it right on the schedule there.
Okay, Justin, anything else you want to add before we leave? Oh, wait, I do have one more question. Where can people find out more about this if they couldn't keep up with all the things we're saying? Is that available on your website?
Yeah, I would definitely encourage people to just go to skihall.com, skihall.com, and you can hover over induction and click on tickets or schedule and get all the info you need there.
Okay, anything else to add before we go?
No, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We'll be right back after this. The Park City Senior Center is now open 4 days a week. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports on the extended hours.
The Senior Center is now open Monday through Thursday. Previously, it was only open 2 days a week. It's located on Woodside Avenue, down the street from Library Field. The updated hours are 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. Wednesdays, the center opens to members in the Bridge and Mahjong classes. Lunch will still be served Mondays and Thursdays. Registration's required, and a $3 donation is suggested. The president of the Park City Senior Center Board, Liz Novak, says the expanding hours will help accommodate growing demand. The center has more than 500 members.
Fortunately, we don't have 500 members come to the center the days that we're open. But when they do come, we are cheek to jowl.
That's her speaking at the February 28th Summit County Council meeting. The council allocated $94,000 for senior services in fiscal year 2024, $8,200 of that specifically for Park City, which Novak says helped expand Park City's hours. Utah law requires counties to provide senior services. Summit County operates three senior centers in Park City, Colville, and Camas. Here is Craig Weekly, another Park City board member.
There continues to be a challenge of isolation and loneliness, depression for a large number of people in the county who are seniors. And yet the senior center movement, if you will, here in Colville, in Camas, and in Park City, I think is doing a tremendous amount to address those issues.
Any Summit County resident 60 years or older can join. More information is available at summitcounty.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Members of the International Olympic Committee will visit sporting venues across the Wasatch back next month as Utah looks to clinch the 2034 Games bid. Parker Malatesta reports.
The IOC delegation plans to visit the Utah Olympic Park and Soldier Hollow Nordic Center during its trip April 9th to 13th, in addition to sites in the Salt Lake Valley. A concept map released by the IOC doesn't list every venue, but indicates the group could also visit Park City Mountain and Deer Valley, including the resort's new base in Wasatch County along US 40. The trip is an opportunity for members of the IOC's future host commission to see Utah's Olympic venues up close before they vote whether to recommend bringing the games back to Salt Lake City. During a call with journalists this week, IOC Future Olympic Games host director Jacqueline Barrett talked about the value they see in Utah.
Salt Lake and Utah are so enthusiastic and so keen on hosting the games again. And I think that that is, you know, clearly a demonstration of what was a fabulously successful games, a great experience. And they want to recreate that for a new generation and give a new generation of young people and athletes that opportunity.
Olympic Games Executive Director Christoph Duby was asked about the Utah legislature's efforts to fund a new baseball stadium and arena in Salt Lake City. While Duby said the IOC would consider new venues, he said that's not an excuse to build them.
We will be opportunistic and flexible if these venues do make sense because they have been built in the meantime. But let's not create the link between investment in these venues and their necessity for the Olympic Games.
Following the visit next month, the IOC's future host commission will be tasked with submitting a report to the IOC executive board, which will decide whether to call an election for the IOC session to award the games. The IOC session is expected to vote on awarding the games July 24th, or Pioneer Day, on the eve of the Summer Olympics in Paris. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour.